Welcome to the Couchcast, and this week we're listening back to one of the UK's most loved railway authors. One of his most recent books, To the Sea by Train, is still a bestseller, and his Reading on Trains is one of the most popular British Substacks. His name is Andrew Martin, and I first asked him about his childhood in York.
Well, I spent a lot of time on trains as a kid because my dad worked for British Rail, and I had free first-class railway travel, a privilege ticket, it was called. I think it entitled me to about 30 journeys a year. So as young as maybe 13, in the summer holidays, I would say, Dad, I'm off to London. And I would just get on the train to London in the early morning and come back on the one that used to leave at King's Cross at about 2 o'clock in the morning, I think, because it's called the Milk Special. That doesn't exist anymore. But I spent a heck of a lot of time on trains, sort of daydreaming and speculating about the strangers I met on trains. And I suppose that's why I began to write novels set on trains.
Wow. What a lucky person to be able to just jump on trains for free. Yep. That's amazing. Yeah,
it was a great perk.
Your interest in railways started obviously with this fantastic privileged pass, and you were able to explore the country even as a teenager. What did you study at university, Andrew?
History.
Ah, and how was that? Did you find your student life was a good introduction, a good place to study?
I'm not sure that I was really into railways at that point. I was just spending a lot of time on trains. I was mainly interested in 19th and early 20th century British history. And I think the reason that when I began writing railway fiction, I set it in Edwardian times, in other words, the early 20th century, that was something to do with political history at the time that I'd studied at university. Mm. But I also found that period aesthetically attractive because it was sufficiently like today to be understandable. I mean, I didn't want to go even as far back as mid-Victorian, because then you got blokes wearing weird 3-foot-tall top hats and it's too strange. But if an Edwardian chap walked into your local pub when you were in it, you probably wouldn't look twice at him. He'd be dressed very similarly to today, but probably more elegantly. Hmm. He'd probably have bad teeth, but you wouldn't know that. Even if his job was digging holes in the road, he'd wear a tie. There was no fluorescent light. It was gas light, and that was more attractive, and there was no plastic, and the high streets were not as scruffy as they are today. So in a way, and it was a bad time to be poor, I know, but in a way it was a more beautiful look.
Halcyon days.
It was halcyon if you were well off, you know, let's face it. But it had an aesthetic appeal to me, and I found it quite an easy period to evoke in print.
Mm. And you didn't end up using much history because I believe you went on to be a barrister, is that right? Did you train in law as well?
I did a postgraduate conversion course to law, and then I qualified as a barrister, but I never practiced.
So your Amazon page says that you drifted into writing while you were practicing law. I don't mean to sound cheeky, but was the legal profession just a bit uninspiring for you?
I did find that I didn't make many friends on the law course. I didn't find that people were very like-minded. And I began to write freelance journalism when I was doing the law. That sort of gradually overtook the law, and I spent more and more time doing that. I think the trouble with the law people was that I found them a bit too serious. I was a bit intimidated also by the prospect of being a lawyer. I sometimes regret not being a lawyer because I did like the law. I loved the logic of it and the clarity of it. And I loved the prose of it as well, very simple prose. Lawyers often write beautifully, better than many professional writers. But I didn't like the idea of having somebody's whole life in my hands, you know, their fate. I would have been a criminal barrister and, you know, the prospect of making a mistake so that somebody went to prison for 10 years, I found that a bit terrifying.
Oh, absolutely. Steer away from prison if at all possible. And I believe your first book was a kind of a comic novel about two journalists. I think it was from 1999, wasn't it? Can you tell us a bit about that?
That was a satire on the kind of journalism that I did when I first went into journalism, which was lifestyle journalism. And one character in the novel writes a column called Me and My Pen, in which he interviews so-called celebrities about their pens. And that was very characteristic of the type of journalism that was happening in the late 80s, when lifestyle was very important. Murdoch had broken the print unions, and so the newspapers expanded enormously. So you'd have 20-page property supplements in the Sunday papers. You could easy to place articles for them. Nobody would read the article or notice it, but still, it was a boom time to be a freelance journalist. And that's when I got into it. And Mickey take that novel, it was called Bilton, of lifestyle journalism, really.
Mm. Now, you produced a couple of books not really related to railways, but something was afoot, wasn't it, around the early 2000s?
I wrote a column in the Evening Standard magazine called Tube Talk, which was about the Underground, which was an idea borrowed from maybe the New Yorker or the New York Times, but the editor of the magazine had seen a similar thing in America, which was called Subway Talk. And so he said, why don't we do one called Tube Talk? And he knew that my dad had worked on the railways, so he offered it to me. And I loved doing it. And when in the course of doing it, I read about, I think it was the 150th anniversary of Waterloo Station. And I was going to write something about the Underground at Waterloo or something. But when I started looking into Waterloo, I found out about the Necropolis Line. And that was a bizarre operation where dead bodies were taken from a little private station just around the corner from Waterloo down to Brookwood Cemetery, which was and is a massive cemetery. It was said to be the largest cemetery in the British Empire. And the idea of the Brookwood Necropolis and Mausoleum Company was that literally everyone who died in London would be taken on their little railway down to Brookwood Cemetery. Well, it didn't quite work out like that, but it's a very ambitious project. And the London and South Western Railway supplied the motive power for the funeral trains, the tank engines, I think it were, and the carriages as well. And you could go first, second or third class as a mourner, and you could send your departed granny first, second or third class as well. It would be it wouldn't be quite the thing, I suppose, to go first class yourself and send your deceased relative third. But, well, it was all very odd.
Classism but, still alive and well when we're on our last journey.
Well, of course, it was long a feature of the railways and even in death. And when I thought this was a good subject for a novel, and I went to my publisher, and they'd already published a couple of books by me, and I said, well, how about this weird setup, the Necropolis Line? And he said, well, what sort of novel do you envisage that being? I said, well, it's not going to be a romantic comedy, is it? It seemed to lend itself naturally to a crepuscular, a dark railway thriller. And I wanted a naive character to be working on that line, someone who people try to take advantage of. In fact, there's a sort of criminal conspiracy, and they lure this naive young guy from the north to work on that line. And he is like a young sort of train spotter, you would call him today, but that wasn't a term in use at the time. The novel's set in, I think, 1901, and that's Jim Stringer. And then eventually there were 10 novels featuring Jim Stringer, and he gradually got more worldly. He sort of grew up in the course of the novels, and he became, in the first two, he's just an ordinary railwayman aspiring to be a driver and a cleaner and then a trainee fireman. But he kept coming across dead bodies, and I thought that's a bit implausible, especially when I read somewhere that there are only 5 murders on the railways of Britain between about 1825 and 1890 or something. Yet Jim was coming across 5 in every book. So I decided to make him a policeman, a railway detective.
And they did quite well, I believe, your 10 detective stories.
Yeah, collectively they sold more than 300,000 copies, I was told.
Wow.
But I wouldn't say that's a life-changing event. So they sold healthily, but they were never really mega sellers. And of course, what you want with a thing like that is for it to be made into a TV series. And, and they were optioned a couple of times for that, but nothing ever materialised. Whether Jim will ever resurface, I don't know. He might do if someone's interested in taking him on, another publisher.
I believe as A.J. Martin, you wrote a book called The Night in Venice as well, and that has a scene set on the Simplon Express, Paris to Venice.
Yeah.
Were you lucky enough to research that yourself? Have you been on the line?
I have been to Venice on a night train from Paris, and that was a train run by Fellow, T-H-E-L-L-O, who were, I think, an Italian company, and they've faded out during COVID or after COVID, but they ran a night train from Paris to Venice, and I went on that, and in fact I experienced a crime because I had 100 euros stolen out of my wallet.
Oh.
When I went to the dining car, to collect a novel that I'd left in the dining car earlier on when I had dinner. And at about 1 o'clock in the morning, I thought, oh, I've left that book, which was itself a crime novel, in the dining car. I better go and get it. And I went to get it, and I didn't ask the attendant to lock my compartment, which he'd offered to do. So the compartment was left open. And on the way to the dining car at 1 o'clock in the morning, as we were going through Switzerland, I bumped into this burly guy in a leather jacket. And I later found out that he wasn't supposed to be on the train. He'd got on at some service stop or something. And he was a well-known criminal. And he undoubtedly is the one who took the 100 euros out of my wallet.
Goodness, life is stranger than fiction.
Well, that's a genuine railway crime. And I wrote about it at some length in that chapter on that train in my book, non-fiction book, Night Trains. But the novel, The Night in Venice, is about a slightly disturbed 14-year-old girl. It's set in 1911. She goes to Venice with her guardian. She's an orphan. And they go on the train, the Simplon Express, wagon-lit train. And there's quite a sort of elaborate description of that, which I hope is more or less accurate. Although I think I had them change at Milan, which they wouldn't necessarily have done. But otherwise, it's supposed to be quite accurate. But so that's not a railway novel. It's a historical crime novel, but it does have quite a long train journey in it. And I think even all my non-railway novels have quite a lot of trains in them.
You can't escape them.
I can't get it.
Today, we're talking with one of Britain's most prolific railway writers, Andrew Martin. But I'm going to ask him a strange question. How do you get things really flat?
Well, this is a reference to a book that I wrote called How to Get Things Really Flat, A Man's Guide to Ironing, Dusting and Other Household Arts. So I think that's all pretty self-explanatory. I've always done quite a lot of housework. My mother died when I was young, so I always used to do a lot of cleaning. And my dad was always very keen on ironing, I think, because he'd been in the army. And whenever I went off to a job interview or any special occasion, he would make a sort of a ritual out of ironing my shirts and my trousers. And so I've always liked ironing as well. And it's a book about how to do it. So it's also meant to be funny.
Well, it's a darn good job that we don't have video on this interview, because you would be horrified by my lack of ironing. Before we talk about some of my favourite books of yours, you did produce a quirky combination of quotations in 2006, I believe. So I'm going to ask you a few quickfire questions, Andrew.
Oh, God.
Who said this one? Just because I don't care doesn't mean I don't understand.
I don't know.
I thought you would know that one because it was Homer Simpson, and you mentioned Simpson.
Oh, he's mentioned in the subtitles.
Yeah. It's one of my favourite ones. He's just so awful. OK, let's try another one.
Didn't Homer Simpson also say, here's to beer, cure, cause of and cure of all life's problems?
Oh, he's got some brilliant quotes.
Yes.
OK, let's do another one. It costs a lot of money to make a person look this cheap.
That sounds familiar, but I can't say who said it. You have to remember that it's more than 20 years, or what was it, 15 years since I did that book.
It was Dolly Parton. The course of true love is not a railway.
Oh, I do know that one. That's in Pickwick Papers, and it's the heading of one of the chapters, and that's by Dickens, obviously, and he was not keen on railways.
Correct.
That's why.
Which brings us nicely back on track. Sorry about that.
That's okay.
To summarise your entire opus, it's kind of the way that trains stimulate the imagination. And I think for the 150th anniversary of the Capital's tube system, you produced Underground Overground. Can you tell us about putting that one together, please?
Well, the subtitle of that is A Passenger's History of the Tube. So it's meant to be a book that is explaining the social history of the tube, the aesthetics of the tube, and some of the engineering, but not that much of the number crunching and technical side of it, because I don't know about that side of it. I think I have a particular perspective on the tube because I came to London from the north. So to me, it was a novelty, you know. So I had an outsider's view of it. The fact that you sat with your back to the side of the carriage, like on the waltzer at the fairground, that always amazed me, you know. And the way that the tube train barely seemed to fit in the tunnels. You kept thinking it was going to swing to the side and smash into the wall of the tunnel. I spent the first 10 years living in London thinking that was going to happen any minute.
All that scraping noises that you hear.
Yeah, and the weird noises of the brakes and everything. And I used to be fascinated by the guards. I don't think any of the guards ever came from the north. They're always quintessential hard-bitten Cockneys, you know. So to me, it was like a Dickensian spectacle, and that's still how I think of it.
Even with all the modernisation. You described the years leading up to the first subterranean railway so well, all those schemes by the city solicitor Charles Pearson at the time. How desperately was something actually needed in London in the 1850s and 60s?
Well, I think London was beginning to be very crowded, and there were slums all around the city of London, rookeries, as they were called, and there was a need to get people into more salubrious conditions. I don't think the city was a financial centre in those days, but it was a sort of centre of small manufacturing and lots of businesses, very congested. And so it was to sort of alleviate the social problems around Clerkenwell and around EC1 that the first tube, the Metropolitan Railway, was created. So it was created as a piece of social engineering, altruistic on the part of this guy, Charles Pearson. So not to make money, really. It was created as a social reform.
Mm. And there was a great time of reformers, wasn't it, with Basilgate and all the other works going on in the
yeah,
capital?
Yeah, a great rationalisation of London, yeah.
Now, after a slight detour with your next book, I believe it was, you came back to writing more train-based works. Can you tell us about some of those ones, Bells and Whistles and The Night Trains and Seats of London, those books?
Well, I've written 7 or 8 non-fiction railway books. Seats of London is about maquette, which is a particular interest of mine, which is the woolen seat covering on tube trains and ordinary trains and buses. And as far as I know, Seats of London is, which is subtitled A Field Guide to Maquette or something like that, is the only book on the subject, as far as I know. So that's a particular niche that I'm very pleased to occupy, because I think maquette can be very beautiful, and it's gradually constantly evolving, so it says a lot about the period of time that it was implemented. Each maquette will tend to be on the trains for about 10 years, so it's not there forever, and it reflects the fashions of the time.
A lot of those beautiful pieces of fabric actually made in your home Yorkshire area.
Yeah, that was another thing that interested me about maquette, a kind of north-south partnership. Most of it made by, a lot of it made by two firms in Halifax. And there used to be, I think in 1930, there were notices in tube carriages saying all the maquette in this carriage made in Halifax, Yorkshire. And the ironic thing is, made by people working on the looms in those mills, they probably never went to London, or very rarely. So they wouldn't have seen the beautiful maquette that they manufactured in situ. Mm. They just saw it rolling off the looms in the hundreds of yards.
And you, at that point, you'd not stopped producing fiction too during this period as well, hadn't you? There was Diamond and Soot and Martian and Winker and several other books. Do you want to tell us a little bit about a couple of those before?
Well, for example, The Yellow Diamond was a novel about the super rich in Mayfair and a special unit of the police that investigates them. The Winker was set in 1976. It's about a failed pop star who winks at people and then kills them. And there is, in fact, several train journeys in that. Journey from Paris to Nice. Quite a lot of the book is set in France. I love Nice, and Nice railway station figures quite a lot in that book. And it's set in the hot summer of 1976.
You are one prolific chap, Andrew, and there's still more to discuss. So you've told us all about your fictional works and many of your railway books, and then you wrote a whole book about a city that's close to both of our hearts, the wonderful Paris.
Yes, I wrote a book about the Paris Metro, a bit like the Tube book, a book sort of explaining the Paris Metro in a non-technical way. And it's called Metropolitaine, an Ode to the Paris Metro. When I first met my wife, she was living in Paris, so I spent quite a lot of time there. I've always loved Paris anyway. And I always had a romantic attachment to the metro, which annoys some people because they think the underground, London Underground, is superior and even more beautiful. But I think, in a way, the metro is more beautiful for its elegance and simplicity. The basic formula of white vault, that's what the stations are, rather than the tube, which is like a rat in a drain pipe. And the simple formula for writing the station names, white on blue, it's very spare, the basic metro station, and that always attracted me.
Mm. Having spent a bit of time in Paris myself, the thing that always never ceases to amaze me is that both Brits going to Paris and also Parisians coming to the UK, the contrasts and the similarities are quite striking. So you've got a large number of similarities, but also these contrasts. What do you think the metro could learn from the underground and vice versa?
Well, the basic thing that appeals to me about the metro is some something the underground can't do anything about. It's not so claustrophobic as the tube. The tube is one train in one tunnel. I'm talking about the deep level tube lines now, not the cut and cover lines. And all the Paris metro is like cut and cover lines. It's like Circle, District, Metropolitan in London. In other words, it's more companionable. Two trains in a vault-shaped tunnel. Two trains side by side. So you can see trains going the other way on the adjacent line. So basically, the tunnels are wider. And that's one reason I like the metro. And the metro is not as deep. That helps the claustrophobia as well. You know, it's just you walk down a flight of stairs usually to get to the station. And also the entrances are frequently very beautiful. Those lovely Art Nouveau entrances by Guimard. I love those. And I love the way they're illuminated with lamps that look like flowers. Lilies of the valley, they look like. I love seeing those in a Parisian street at night. And the distance between the stops is shorter on the metro. And the trains seem to come in and leave the stations very quickly. So it's kind of brisker. And as I get older, I am more and more afflicted with claustrophobia, and I sometimes have to get off a very crowded tube train, or I won't get on it. So this is something that I never experience on the metro.
We'll come on to your latest books in a moment, but you've also produced several documentaries about railways, haven't you? Tell us about your time shift programmes, please.
Well, these were programmes made by the BBC, but which I presented and wrote the script. A couple of them are repeated. I never know in advance when they're going to be repeated, but what happens is I walk down the road the next day and someone does a double take when they see me, and my book sales go up. There's a little blip in my book sales. One is called Between the Lines, the Literature of Railways, and that's about fiction and poetry to do with railways. And then another one is called The Trains That Time Forgot. That's not my title. It's about the trains that time didn't forget, like the Brighton Bell, the Cornish Riviera Express, and famous trains, Flying Scotsman. And it follows the formula of some of my books, whereby I'm basically comparing the present day situation with the past.
So let's move on to one of your most recent books. I understand probably one of your bestsellers, really, To the Sea by Train. It just came out this year, and it's absolutely chock full of detail about the development of railway resorts, isn't it?
Yeah, that's about trains to the seaside and how I try to evoke the excitement that used to be involved in that. You know, let's say in about 1910, you lived in Halifax, and Halifax closed down for a week or for a fortnight every year. It was called a Wakes Week holiday when they would refurbish the mills. And you'd get the trains to Blackpool for a week. And imagine if you were a kid, you might never have seen the sea before. And you come out Central Station, Blackpool, right on the front. First thing you do is walk into the sea and paddle just to prove that you've arrived. That's what they used to do. So that's kind of the central motif of the book, the excitement, trying to rekindle that excitement, showing what's left of it. And then talking about how the resorts developed. Sometimes they were developed by railway companies, sometimes by a local magnate who saw the fashionability of seaside places, wanted to get in on the action. So it's history, social history really, combined with evocations of modern day journeys to the coast.
And Ventnor gets quite a big mention.
Yeah, the Isle of Wight gets quite a big mention. Beeching wanted to close all the railways on the Isle of Wight. Thank God he didn't succeed. But I used to go to the Isle of Wight as a kid on holiday from Yorkshire, and so I've always liked it. And, well, Ventnor had two stations, Ventnor and Ventnor West. Ventnor West, I think, closed in the 50s, the other one in the 60s. And I went to Ventnor, I cycled there, and I talked to a woman who runs a shop on the front. She said, this town has never been the same since the railway left. It's still a beautiful town. Maybe in a way it's better because it's quieter, but Beeching pulled the plug.
Yeah, great shame, great shame. Can we move on to your most recent online project, please, Andrew, Reading on Trains? First of all, explain to listeners who may not know what Substack is and why you decided to write on it?
Substack is a blog, basically, and it's quite a fashionable platform. And it occurred to me that almost every professional writer I knew had some sort of social media presence, which I never have had. So I thought the best thing would be to have a blog. So I'm not just slagging people off or being bitchy on X or whatever it's called. I write a proper sort of essay every fortnight, and it's a very loose format, but loosely to do with railways, and it's called Reading on Trains. But sometimes sometimes it might just be about something you want to read on a train, not necessarily really reading about trains, if you see what I mean. So it's a kind of play on words.
And your engine has not run out of steam yet, Andrew. Your next book revives an old interest, quite literally the very fabric we sit on. Can you talk to us a bit about the Marquette mystery?
Well, the Marquette book that I mentioned before, the non-fiction book, did quite well. So the publisher had the idea of sort of following it up with a murder mystery whereby a piece of Marquette is a clue to a murder. And it's set in 1938, which was a very good year for Marquette because she had those beautiful Marquettes commissioned by Frank Pick for the 38 tube stocks. And its protagonist is a woman who works in a department store in 1938, lives in Belsize Park in London. So she's on the Northern Line, which had the nice Marquette, 38 Marquettes and 38 trains. And she ends up having to go all over Britain looking for a vehicle that has the same Marquette as this one that's the clue to a murder. So she goes to, well, I won't say because it'd be a plot spoiler, but it's not all set in London. I will say she goes to Halifax, where she's from.
Can we say that she comes to the Isle of Wight as well?
Okay, we can. She does go to the Isle of Wight as well, yeah. But I'm not going to say why. But it's an evocation of Isle of Wight in high summer, you know.
In the absolute spirit of a good detective writer, we are left in suspenders. It's been so, so interesting to talk with a fellow railway enthusiast who's made so many superb books and programmes. I hope you enjoyed listening to this as much as I have. Thank you so much for joining us, Andrew Martin.
Thank you very much, Mark.
You can find most of Andrew's books online, for example, one of his most recent, The Marquette Mystery, or at safehavenbooks.co.uk. UK. His Substack is called Reading on Trains, and his own personal website is martinesque.co.uk. Next week's Catchcast is not to be missed. We are doing more chatting art, transport, communications history. Please join us then.